Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name is James Henderson, and I'm Director of the Gas Programme at OIES. Today, I am joined by Katya Yefimova, a Senior Research Fellow at OIES, and we shall be discussing the current status and future prospects for the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Katya has written and commented extensively on Nord Stream issues, most recently in March 2021 when she published a paper on the OPAL exemption decision. But this podcast is not based on a specific piece of work, but is rather a discussion by popular demand, because so much has been happening around Nord Stream 2 in the past few months. Katya, welcome to the OIES podcast series.
Hello, Jim. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Pleasure to be here.
Jolly good. Okay, well, let me just date stamp this before we start, just so everyone knows that we're recording this on the 21st of June, 2021. But having said that, Katya, let's just start with a couple of minutes of background on the Nord Stream pipes. What was the history of the gas export system?
Well, Nord Stream 2 is a 55 BCM two-line pipeline system to transport Russian gas from Russia to Germany directly under the Baltic Sea. It largely repeats the route of the first two-line pipeline system, Nord Stream 1. Gazprom is the only shareholder in Nord Stream 2, but there are five European companies which have provided half of financing towards the project. The financial decision to proceed was taken in 2017. Just as Nord Stream 1, Nord Stream 2 reflects, in my view, Gazprom's difficult transit history with transit countries, particularly Ukraine, but also Belarus and Moldova. So Nord Stream 2 system really reflects determination to diversify export routes to Europe and above all to remove Ukraine's monopoly in respect of transit of Russian gas to any European customer. And this system, Nord Stream 2, just as Nord Stream 1, is a shorter and cheaper export route for Gazprom towards Europe.
Okay, and in terms of its construction then, can you just talk me through the process we've been through and where we are with construction now?
Nord Stream 2 is running with delay, obviously, because its plant commission date of end 2019 was delayed due to many factors, most importantly, late grant of Danish permit, but crucially because of a threat of the US sanctions, because those sanctions have effectively forced the Swiss company Allseas to withdraw its pipeline vessels from the area, leaving the project, and which necessitated the fact that Gazprom and Nord Stream 2 had to find replacement vessels, the Russian vessels, the two of them main pipeline vessels involved in the job, that is Fortuna and Academic Chersky. They were brought in specifically to finalize construction. The first line has just been completed very recently on the 4th of June, and pre-commissioning was announced to start on the 11th of June. There are various estimates on how much it remains to be left. It's about 80 kilometers, and it suggests that the second line potentially could be completed sometime in August this year. So by the end of that period, there will be two lines completely constructed, the first line already and the second and mid-end August.
And in terms of commissioning then, how long does it take to commission these pipelines?
The length of commissioning really depends on the technique used. If the technique used, which is called a hydrotest, which includes flooding of pipeline with water, that takes a longer time. If a different technique, which is called dry pre-commissioning, which does not involve a hydrotest, which is the major, the longest part of commissioning process, then it could be done much shorter.
So first gas from the first line could flow by the end of this year, practically?
Once pre-commissioning stage is complete, for example, you know, again, it's difficult to tell how long it will take without knowing which technique will be used. If you assume a couple of months, for example, then once that is concluded, then what would need to happen first is an independent third party should come in and provide a technical certification of the pipeline that it's ready to operate, to issue a certificate. So unless and until such certificate is issued, the gas cannot start flowing. So that's really the key first factor.
And is that factor impacted by sanctions? I mean, the sanctions obviously haven't stopped the pipeline being constructed. So are sanctions going to affect other parts of the commissioning process?
Sanctions, well, if let's talk about sanctions now, because it's kind of multi-faceted issue. In terms of what the impact to date has been, the biggest impact more generally was that sanctions legislation, particularly the first one, CARTS legislation adopted in 2017, created uncertainty and threat of future sanction for the project. That was an early impact. Despite the fact that CARTS effectively contained a grandfathering clause in respect of investment and loans made prior to its adoption date. But most obvious tangible impact was, of course, the decision of the Swiss All Seas company to suspend construction works under the threat of PESA legislation adopted in the end of 2020, because that legislation specifically targeted pipeline vessels. And this factor alone has delayed finalization of construction of the pipe at least for a year, and now more than for a year. And effectively, Nord Stream 2 had to bring a Russian vessel, Academic Chersky, around the globe from the Far East to the Baltic Sea to continue construction. So that was a very tangible impact. Less obvious, but of course, still tangible impact, and that's kind of coming to answer your question, was the decision of several Western companies providing engineering services, certification services, and insurance to suspend their participation in the project over the course of November last year through January this year, under the threat of yet another sanctions legislation, this time PESCA, adopted at the end of last year. And PESCA is important because it's very much all-encompassing and expands to pretty much any type of activity associated with Nord Stream 2, including pipeline activity, vessel technology upgrades, vessel insurance, as well as pipeline certification. This challenge is yet to be overcome because, as I said before, Nord Stream 2 must be certified before it can start flowing gas. There could be, the question is whether Western companies would be able to do, and that only would be possible if the waiver were to be provided, which is arguably a long shot at present, or it would be some Russian company that would be able to do that certification job. And those are two scenarios I could see, but then it's probably too early to tell which one will take place, but that will very much have a significant impact, obviously, on when gas might start flowing.
Okay, so just to summarize, physically the pipeline's ready, and it would be essentially commissioned, could be commissioned by the autumn, but the certification process is really the one that could hold things up. If that doesn't happen, then the gas won't flow even if the pipe's ready.
Yeah, certification is necessary for the gas to start flowing. That's the necessary factor.
And so the US sanctions are still having an impact. Is there any sense that a compromise might be reached with the EU over, you know, proceeding from here with sanctions? Is there any sort of sense that the US might soften its stance?
Well, at least for the time being, it looks there is a compromise between the US and the EU, or actually between the US more specifically, between the US and Germany, in fact. And although the PESCA legislation, the latest one, it mandated sanctions, it also provided the Biden administration with a certain degree of leeway of in respect of implementation or non-implementation of sanctions. And This is provided by the fact that this legislation envisages or mandates, in fact, consultations with EU member states, with the UK, with Norway and Switzerland, before sanctions could be imposed. It also says that it is impossible to sanction state agencies of those countries. It also envisages a possibility of granting a waiver. And in fact, we saw recently that the Biden administration decided to use that leeway. Specifically, it issued a waiver in respect of Nord Stream 2 and its CEO in May this year. And it got much criticism for this from the Congress, but that was the administration decision, which in my view is pragmatic and rational. And why? Because it reflects the US understanding that sanctions would not stop Nord Stream 2 construction anyway, but would ruin its relationship with Germany. And it does need Germany's cooperation on various international dossiers. And to come into the second part of your question, whether that means that it's pretty much the road is clear for Nord Stream 2, my answer would be not quite so, because the fact that the US resigned itself that construction will be finalized, this doesn't mean that the US no longer opposed to Nord Stream 2. I think it still is, both for political reasons and for commercial reasons, and which is why, in my view, it is unlikely to completely cease its efforts to obstruct the project. But such obstruction now is more likely referred to sort of not construction stage, but to operational stage, including our certification process, for example. Again, it could place further obstacles in respect of certification. On the other hand, it could choose not to place further obstacles, or indeed agree to remove the already existing obstacles as part of its wider agreement with Germany. And how that could happen, it could happen, in my view, if Germany assures that the United States that some of Nord Stream 2 capacity would be restricted, and post-2024 Ukraine transit will continue to some extent. Having said that, I would also caution that the scope of such restriction, the amount of capacity cap on Nord Stream 2, would be pretty limited.
So let's come to that then. So on the assumption then that the pipeline is constructed and gas can flow, what's the role of the German regulator in potentially restricting flows, and what's the role of the EU in potentially restricting flows along the lines of some of the sort of grand bargain that you've described?
Right. Well, strictly speaking, the German regulator or the European Commission, they can't control the overall Nord Stream 2 volumes, but what could be done is that some capacity restriction could be set and applied to Nord Stream 2, and therefore limiting, rather than controlling, limiting the amount of gas which would be flowing via that pipeline system. However, I think it's difficult to see how one could impose a cap on Nord Stream 2 such that would come into the conflict with Eugel legally binding long-term bookings without triggering protracted litigation. Eugel are onshore connecting pipelines on the German territory, and they connect to Nord Stream 2 and the capacity exactly matching that of Nord Stream 2. Neither the German regulator nor the Commission raised any concerns to the procedure under which Eugel capacity was booked, and it was booked in line with the applicable energy law provisions of the EU at the time. If we are to talk about exemption, the Opal exemption decision, which although refers to onshore connecting pipelines for Nord Stream 1 rather than Nord Stream 2, the Opal exemption decision is one of the main instruments, one would have thought, which could influence Nord Stream 2 utilization. Why? Because at present, a 50% cap is imposed on Opal by the existing exemption in place, and the gas which couldn't fit into Opal, therefore, was flowing via Eugel. But that has been happening until now, that Nord Stream 2 is not ready to operate yet. But clearly, if that situation continues, that would limit our oil gas availability for Nord Stream 2 capacity, and therefore would limit our utilization of Nord Stream 2. We are expecting the judgment made by the Court of Justice as announced on the 15th of July. So that's an important milestone to watch, and clearly that will have an impact on de facto utilization of Nord Stream 2 going forward.
So can we do a little bit of maths then? Can you remind our listeners what's the capacity of Øygard and how much has been contracted of Øygard so far?
Okay, Øygard capacity is 55 BCM, the same as that of Nord Stream 2, and 80% of Øygard, which is 44 BCM, is contracted.
So essentially you're saying that from a Nord Stream 2 perspective, it would be very difficult to limit the availability of Nord Stream 2 below that 44 BCM. It'd be very difficult legally to create a limit lower than 44 BCM for Nord Stream 2.
It would be very difficult to impose a limit on Nord Stream 2 such that would come into conflict with these 80% bookings on Øygard capacity. But there is a caveat now that Øygard for a couple of years now has been flowing gas from Nord Stream 1, which did not fit into Opal because of the Opal capacity cap. So that takes it even lower. So there is already certain utilization of Øygard with this about 12, 13 BCM of Opal gas. And then one allows for further to reach 8% long-term bookings. And then it leaves 20% for short and term reservation as under the European energy law. So you could see that if Opal cap is preserved at 50% and Øygard is allowed to be utilized at 100%, and that you count long and short term bookings, that Nord Stream 2 utilization could be about 66%. And in that case, if you combine Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 utilization, you would get to about 88% figure utilization of combined Nord Stream 1 and 2. But there could be different scenarios, and that very much depends also what Opal cap would be and how, again, Opal how Øygard capacity is treated, because 8% is booked long-term, but it doesn't mean that 20% cannot be used. 20% not to be used, but on a shorter-term basis as opposed to long-term bookings.
Okay, so important then to understand what might happen with Opal more specifically. You've mentioned July as a key time for a decision being made. What do you think are the potential outcomes for Opal?
Potential outcome for Opal effectively could be, and that's exactly what I wrote in my paper on Opal, which was out in March this year, is that at present there is a 50% cap because that's what the court reinstated the original Opal exemption decision with such cap. Prior to that, for a few years, Opal was utilized, Gazprom could utilize Opal at 8% plus, so you could have access to at least 8% of capacity. But due to Polish complaint to the court that allegedly the Commission did not assess the impact of energy solidarity while issuing that revised decision, the court decided to return to the original exemption decision of 50%. What court could now do in its judgment, it could leave the existing old exemption in place at 50%. It could reinstate the 2016 exemption, allowing Gazprom to use at least 8% and potentially more, or it could order the Commission just to go back, conduct an assessment of energy solidarity, and that court would have to provide methodology how to do that, because there is no such methodology in place yet. And then on the basis of that, the Commission could issue an amended exemption decision, which could see a completely different cap, or it could see a fluctuating cap, for example. So that's three possible outcomes. And the last one I've mentioned, I think it's the likeliest one.
And So in terms of completeness, then, we should mention one other pipeline, NEL. There's no issues around the NEL pipeline. It can flow. And what are the volumes of the NEL pipeline?
So volumes, it's about 20 BCM, but it's fully regulated pipeline. There is no exemption in respect of NEL. So it's really a non-issue in this case. So the main two issues are OPAL, which is operated under exemption regime, and OIGAL, which is operated and capacity allocated under the procedure, which is called more capacity, and it's modeled on the EU capacity allocation management network code.
Okay, and so just to conclude then on this sort of volumetrics, from what I've understood, you think that the best possible outcome for the entire Nord Stream system, 1 and 2, is for around 88% capacity utilization if everything goes in their favour. Is that right?
That assumes that OPAL cap is preserved at 50% and that Gazprom is able to use OIGAL's capacity completely at 100% on long-term and short-term basis. If 20% on OIGAL capacity would be used by other shippers, potentially as the way of honouring the gas directive's requirement of third-party access, then it could be less. But then again, the OPAL cap could be preserved at a high level, at a lower level. Sorry, it would be a smaller cap than 50%, which is also possible. That's why I said that the cap could be fluctuating. In that scenario, again, there would be more capacity in OIGAL left for Nord Stream 2. So this is just one of the scenarios.
Okay, but I mean, essentially, it's still looking like a reasonably high capacity utilization for the entire Nord Stream system. It's not a disastrous outcome, is the most likely.
Now, if you look at both systems as one, then it's pretty good utilization.
Yeah. Okay. And in terms then of this grand bargain, as we kind of come towards the end of the podcast, obviously there's the question about Ukraine and the utilization of the Ukrainian system. The current contract runs to 2024. You've mentioned the Germans potentially trying to involve future negotiations around that as part of the grand bargain. How do you see the balance between Nord Stream, other Gazprom export pipelines, and the Ukrainian system for the medium to long term?
Right. Well, I think that because in my view, Nord Stream 2 is a transit diversification pipeline, not a transit avoidance pipeline completely. So I do think there will be some transit across Ukraine post-2024. And I see that as continuation, if you like, of the grand bargain that was achieved at the end of 2019 when the post-2019 Ukraine Transit Agreement, which runs till the end of 2024, was concluded. I wouldn't really see it as an entirely new grand bargain. I see it as continuation of the original one. And in a way, the logic here is that one cannot sell the same horse twice, if you like, because Russia has upheld its part of the bargain and it having concluded the Ukraine 5-year transit contract, which was not very favorable to Russia. And now it's for the Germany to uphold its own part of the bargain to clear the remaining obstacles vis-a-vis the United States. So the existing transit agreement with Ukraine 2020-24 has a clause, in fact, which allows for its extension should both parties agree to do so. In my view, Russia could agree to that, to extension, but I think only after Nord Stream 2 is completely cleared to operate from both technical and the regulatory point of view. With safeguards, I think that none of those clearances could be overturned thereafter. And of course, that's important that regulatory clearance, of which we haven't really talked, is that the German regulator would have to certify the Nord Stream 2 operator as compliant with the amended gas directive. And it's up to the German regulator whether to allow gas to flow until and unless such certification process is complete. It has a discretion whether to allow gas flows to start immediately after technical certification is complete, or wait until a regulatory certification is complete either. I also think that it's important to remember that the situation today is very different compared to what it was in late 2019 when Ukraine transit contract was agreed, because back then Gazprom had no access either to Ukrainian capacity, there's no contract, or to Nord Stream 2 capacity because it wasn't built yet. And also Germany made it very clear that Nord Stream 2 could only go ahead if there is continued transit across Ukraine. These were the main factors which, in my view, made it possible to conclude the Ukraine transit agreement. Now its situation is quite different. Gazprom has access to Ukraine's capacity at least until the end of 2024 at the level of 40 BCM per year, but it could book more, albeit at a higher tariff. But also given the tightening global and European gas balance, Gazprom's inability to use Nord Stream 2 at all would simply increase gas prices in Europe. So in my view, yes, it is in everyone's interest to agree on that grand bargain. Whether everyone's interest is sufficient for reaching it, it's an open question, but I believe it may well happen.
So given all these uncertainties, and thank you for bringing up the German regulator, because we needed to talk about that, given the potential for the German regulator to take that decision you've mentioned and for the grand bargain to be reached, what is your, I know it's a speculation, but what is your speculative estimate of when first gas will flow through Nord Stream 2, and how fast do you think it'll take to get up to sort of reasonable volumes?
Right. Again, there are two scenarios, and first scenario is this regulatory certification is the technical certification. We assume that technical certification is done, so somebody comes and certifies the pipeline. And regulatory certification either could happen fast, and gas could start already this side of winter, this year by winter time, or the German regulator could decide to take time and not certify it fast, but run the whole lengthier time period to provide certification to ensure that the pipeline is the operator is in line with the amended gas directive, and it can either allow gas to flow while such certification process, the lengthy one, is ongoing, or it could wait until the certification process is complete and only then allow gas to flow. Under the directive, the length of certification process is about 10 months. So that could take us into the next year. But again, as I said, the German regulator has a discretion over that process.
And is there any sense of when the German regulator may make a decision?
I'd say it's far too early at this point to really say which scenario will happen. I think at present it looks that both scenarios would happen. I would have thought that the German regulator would It kind of brings us into a very speculative territory. The German regulator has a discretion on the issuance of certification. 10 months, which I've said, that's the maximum limit envisaged under regulation. It could take a shorter time, and within that shorter time, conduct certification procedure and then allow gas to flow. It doesn't have to be 10 months. And that is also a possibility. So I think we still could see gas flowing before by winter time, but we could just as well see gas flowing in the next years. It's too early to tell, I think, now.
Okay, well, look, thank you very much. We've come to the end of our time now. That was really interesting. You clearly are very much into the detail of all the issues, and there's clearly a lot to follow over the next 6 months as various decisions are made. So thank you very much indeed for that. You can find Katya's research on these topics, in particular her recent paper on OPAL, on our website. Please do go there and look for Katya's research and also all our other gas research, which you can find on the OIES website. So with that, thank you, Katya, very much for your insights on this fascinating topic. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Stay healthy and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.